The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Every year, we invite some of the most interesting people in America to come talk with us at the New Yorker Festival, writers, musicians, inventors, leaders in government and policy. And today, you'll hear three of those conversations with creative people pushing the envelope in three very distinct fields. We'll hear from Boots Riley, who directed the satirical film Sorry to Bother You, and from Chris Hayes, host of MSNBC's program All In. But we'll start with the writer and trans activist, Janet Mock. Mock made her name with a best-selling memoir called Redefining Realness, which is about her childhood growing up trans in Hawaii and Texas. She writes about gender, sexuality, identity, and self-discovery. The book won a pile of awards, and in the last few years, Mock wrote another book, hosted the podcast Never Before, and contributed to the FX drama Pose, which takes place in the LGBT ballroom scene in 1980s New York. Staff writer Hilton Auld joined Janet Mock in October 2018 to talk about directing, writing, and growing up in Hawaii.
I thought I would start by declaring that there are two Hawaiians that have changed my life, you and Bette Midler. Any state that can produce the two of you is okay by me. So I wanted to, for those folks who haven't seen or read Janet's books, rather, Redefining Realness and Surpassing Realness, it's a really quite extraordinary story. Tell us a little bit about those first years in Hawaii, and also it's a very complex marriage that your parents had. So I think in order to understand where you're going, we need a little bit about where you're coming from.
Yeah, my dad is a black man from Texas. He joined the military, he joined the Navy, and he got stationed, his first duty station was in Hawaii, where he met my mom, who was a civilian working in civilian service on Pearl Harbor Naval Base, where he was stationed. She's a Native Hawaiian woman. They got married, had me and my brother, Chad. And there was some, at least it seemed like a semblance of marital bliss in the beginning. My father loves himself and he loves women. So he went out and, you know, sought out pleasure in the way that he wanted to outside of the commitments he made to my mom, which broke her heart, which led her to a lot of heartache. And I remember one of my only memories, I remember them being in the same room was, and I write about it in my first book, is my mom, my mom's attempt and cry for help by slashing her wrists. And so that sort of dysfunction was the normalcy for me growing up.
There's a really extraordinary section in your first book where your father takes you to Texas and you're exposed to a kind of Christian fundamentalism really that had affected his life. What was that like for you, especially since you were already feeling gender difference in the world?
Well, my father definitely took on the role of, you know, I'm your father and you are my son, mm-hmm. and therefore it's my responsibility to correct you, right? So all of your feminine ways, I need to berate them out of you, police them out of you. So he was like the number one container in that sense. His job was to contain me. Mm-hmm. And so when my mother and father split up, the first thing my mom did was send her two sons to go live with their father.
Did she feel that she was investing in their future masculinity?
Kind of, I think so, but I also think that she was also, you know, looking for a new life and a new start. Mm-hmm. And so by sending her two young children to go live with, you know, their father was a way for her to have a break from having, you know, four children.
Yes.
So she could take care of the older two and then let us go to be with our dad, which was his responsibility to take care of us in that way.
And that was very wrenching for you because you were very close
and loved your mother. I was obsessed with my mother.
Yes. Yeah. How did it work out that you went back to your mother after a time?
I think my godfather, who was my father's Navy buddy, mm-hmm. came to visit us and saw how we were living. Mm-hmm. And he contacted my mother, and my Auntie Joyce did as well. She found her in a phone book. Mm-hmm. And I know, very old school. And they called her up, and I remember O.J. was being chased in the Bronco.
Yes.
When this was happening. Like, I remember the moment when I talked to my mom and I was on the phone with her as this, like, madness was going on television and everyone else was paying attention to this, and I was like, the greatest headline in my life was that my mom is, like, reconnected and talking to me and saying that I'm going to come send for you all.
How long had you been away?
Almost 6 years.
Yes.
And almost 6 years without contact, too.
Why was that contact denied?
I don't think it was denied. I think, well, my father moved around a bunch because once a girlfriend was tired of him, then he moved on to another girlfriend. Usually a long list of single mothers who took us in and like became surrogate mothers to us. And so I think that my mom lost contact. I think my mom also has to, you know, take fault and responsibility for not really prioritizing these two children that were very out of sight, out of mind to her.
Yes.
So she was like, this is your father's turn and I'm gonna go live my life. And she had another baby and she had another fiance and she was very happy in her world until they broke up and then we were back in contact.
How old were you when you went back to Hawaii?
12.
And what was happening to your insides?
Well, I was starting to feel very, I don't like to say the word trapped, but I was feeling very, very tightly contained in my body. Mm-hmm. And I found myself taking these risks and making these social experiments in a sense of like starting to come up with new identities. Mm-hmm. So I had Keisha, who was very near and dear to me, and Keisha started out talking on the phone to boys. And then Keisha wanted to go out into the world and start experimenting. So I remember once I went out as Keisha, I had long curly hair at the time as a tween, and I started this flirtation with this boy who I was just like deeply in love with, mm-hmm. At my cousin's house. And one day he came over and he knocked on the door and asked my aunt, and my father was there, and he asked for Keisha. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, she has long curly hair, da da da, and they're like, Keisha doesn't live here. And then my dad quickly put two and two together, and that's what led to him cutting my hair eventually. And so I think a part of me was seeking out a space in which I could be freer, and that space just happened to come in when my mom sent for us to come back to Hawaii.
Yes.
And she had a lighter touch around all of that stuff. She had a higher quote-unquote tolerance for my gender nonconformity. Mm-hmm. And I was able to meet new friends, and that's when like the queen of my life came in, which was my best friend Wendy, and
yes.
She really was the savior for me.
In your books, gender is so philosophically handled, and I was so moved by what you were saying in terms of society being a fixed thing and that you had tried to adhere to that for mm-hmm. some time before you met Wendy, mm-hmm. and she asked if you were Mahu. I'm so glad that I pronounced it properly, Mahu, and tell the folks what that means.
Well, Mahu is a Native Hawaiian identity and term, a label for people who live outside of the gender binary, largely folk who in our loosely, I guess Western translation would be like trans women. Mm. And so anyone that was outside of the male-female kind of binary who lived outside of that. And so for me, I remember in the seventh grade, my hula teacher was a Mahuvahine.
I love that you had hula lessons. God, I want to live there. Yeah.
I know, yeah. And so like the fact that, you know, the Department of Education in Hawaii hired a trans woman, like my everyday life just was changed and shifted. You know, I didn't have to look to Law and Order or Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, or Silence of the Lambs to see trans people represented. They were a part of my everyday. I had hula lessons three times a week after school. And so Kumu Kauai was this person that was just, she took up space. And she, I hate to use that term, but she normalized, you know, gender nonconformity and being different in that sense. And then I met my best friend, Wendy, who clocked me at the playground and was just like, bitch, what are you trying to do here? Like, we can turn this buzz cut into a Halle Berry do if you want, you know, like, we can remix this. And so she gave me like a...
How old are you?
I was 12.
Yeah.
And I just got so lucky that within the first few months of being there, I found this best friend who had this like, you know, this hallway of femininity in her home. I always saw her as a queen. She very much saw herself as a goddess.
Mm-hmm.
That's her. So I'm gonna respect her identity.
Yeah.
But she was just...
How old is Wendy?
She's a year older than me, but
okay.
We were in the same grade.
Okay.
Because, you know, she's a little slow. in terms of books.
Yeah, yeah.
She could read, but she couldn't read.
Yeah. Right.
But she was very much, she was so big.
Yes.
Like she had when I met her, she had a green bob.
You know,
she wore like super high socks with like, you know, the stripes on them with like rolled up soccer shorts and like a tied top and was just like her backpack bouncing around, you know, the campus.
Yes.
And so because she was so big,
yes.
I could just hide behind her. So if I started tweezing my eyebrows, no one really noticed. Or
yes.
I started, you know, wearing eyeliner, no one really noticed, you know, because Wendy was always doing more. She was always five steps ahead of me.
Yes.
And just so much more brazen. And so that was contagious to have a friend who didn't care so much about what people thought. And I'm not the only girl that she did this to. Like she literally was the passage, like the Underground Railroad was like Wendy's house. Of transitioning.
I was about to say the trans underground room.
Yeah.
That is the best TV movie. You have to write it, please. Trans Underground Railroad. I've been living for this. That is the greatest thing ever.
That's what it was. It was just a space of play. And she just made it seem so just easy. Like you just make a choice. Like this is just what you do. And then you do this next. And here's these other girls that you can meet. And here's other examples of people. I remember...
And also how to be safe, too.
Yeah, and how to be safe. And then she just had this network of people that she knew. And so she introduced me to drag queens, and she introduced me to trans women who performed in, you know, drag clubs. And I remember I would have these, like, kind of these breakdowns and stuff because someone said something about me at school or, you know, and Wendy was just so dismissive of it. Like, she did not tolerate that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just like, why do you care so much about what people think?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she just constantly challenged me in that way. And this is in middle school.
Right.
You know, and so like this sense of self, like she became the foundation into which I found self-confidence and self-assuredness and certainty in who I knew I was
mm-hmm.
versus what everyone else was telling me that I should be, whether that was at home or at school or with teachers. She was the person that was just like, you need to be sure about who you are. Like, why would you want to be wobbly about that? Why would you even let that be open to debate?
Well, because the emotional transition happens way before the physical,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
What was happening to you emotionally in terms of transitioning?
I knew very, after meeting Wendy, I knew very early on about the, you know, the idea of medical transition. Like you take Premarin and then you go on to shots and then, you know, you have whatever surgeries you want to have. Like I knew that like it was 1, 2, 3, done, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it was always something that I was planning toward. I didn't know how I would economically be able to afford it.
Mm-hmm.
We're listening to the writer Janet Mock talking with Hilton Alls. And just to be aware here, the conversation addresses the sex work that Janet was drawn into when she was very young. It might not be suitable for everyone.
One of the sort of harrowing sections of your book, the first book, certainly, is getting the money to pay for the transition.
Mm.
Tell us about what was necessary for you to pay for it.
Yeah, for us, you know, there was this block called Merchant Street,
mm-hmm.
Which was in downtown Honolulu. It's where the girls worked. They were engaged in sex work, in the sex trades. For me, it was, I remember I first went there when I was like 15, when I was able to like go out at nighttime. Mm-hmm. And we would just go and like hang out with the girls and like talk to them and see them. And they were these glamorous goddesses who, to me, were just so... At first, I came in very much with like my National Junior Honor Society hat on, which was like, I could never do what they do. That's disgusting. Or, you know, all these puritanical views that I had in my head about what it meant to use your body, your only asset in a world that's not taking care of you, to really take care of yourself, mm-hmm. right? And so I remember I was given an, an opportunity with this woman named Cheyenne, and she... had this regular who had basically, you know, outgrown her and was, you know, whatever. And he pulled up and saw me and he was like, I want her. Mm-hmm. And I remember this sense of looking at myself and again, this same like dissonance from like this experience about to happen to me, then also thinking about the different kinds of ways and alternatives that I could have had. And at this point, I wanted to graduate to Shots. And I knew that my mom, too, at that time was struggling with addiction and codependency in her relationship. And so home was very unstable. Mm-hmm. And so the way in which I wanted to feel stable was to take control of my body. And so I knew that by doing this $60 hand job that I would be able to have 2 months of hormones. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I remember making that decision to get in that car and at 15 years old to do this and to continue to do this with this man for like the next 2 years of my life. And that was my way in to sex work.
Another parallel, part of the parallel to that story about the body is the story of the mind. Mm. And one of the things that is so impressive, of course, are the ways in which you write and become an intellectual, and not just about things that affect you, but about the world. Your consciousness starts growing once you become a college student. And can we talk a little bit about those years? Mm-hmm. Because you were secretly writing too. Mm-hmm. And then you had a wonderful therapist who suggested, why don't you keep on with the writing thing?
Yeah. I was very resistant. Yeah.
Yes. And it's a great book and I won't give most of it away, but can we talk about your development as a mind and as a writer?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think once I got out of myself, at least in terms of like, you know, how I felt in my body, I started sharing my body and then also just expanding the way in which I thought about all the things that I was going through at the time. And so I think one of my first relationships was probably the first space in which I started telling stories about experiences that were very that I had just had. Mm-hmm. And so like having this boyfriend and sharing, you know, who I was kind of the first points in which I was actually exploring myself and what I thought and what I thought about what I went through and the people in my life. And so that's kind of what started me writing. In grad school, I think moving to New York City, which just was a calling ever since I watched Felicity.
Can we rewind a little bit to talk about how you got to New York and why you wanted to get to New York? Other than Felicity.
I felt like it was a place where you could be yourself.
Yeah.
I felt it was so big that no one would pay attention to me.
Yeah. Good luck. Yeah.
it seemed like the perfect place to just kind of blend in. But I think there was also this sense for me too, was like growing up on this small island, there was only like 2 degrees of separation. And so because I transitioned through high school and middle school, everyone knew that I was trans. Mm-hmm. And so like that became the leading, you know,
narrative.
Adjective
yes,
about
narrative.
Me before I even came into a room.
Yes.
And so I was felt so contained by my history and by people's remembrances of me when I was a boy, right?
Yes.
Or when I'm presented as a boy. And so it was like a great escape for me to go to New York. And there I made the decision not to be open about being trans. And it was freeing to be like another young person figuring out who I was and being in student loan debt and going to NYU.
What were you majoring in?
Journalism.
And what was it that you thought that you could do as a journalist that you couldn't do, let's say, as a fiction writer? Were you just not drawn to fiction?
A trade, number one. I felt I could make money being a journalist. Like, there's jobs for that. Whereas a fiction writer, I was like, how am I supposed to afford doing this?
Yes.
And so for me, it was practicality. I was like, I can work at a fashion magazine and eventually become a features editor or something. That was my dream and my goal at the time.
But something happened. You started to write celebrity pieces to support yourself, but that got very sort of tired very quickly.
It did. Yes.
Why was that?
There's only so much you can write about Angelina Jolie and her children.
Yes. And you started to do something. Was it with the support of this therapist, this idea of writing about yourself?
Yeah, he just told me, he was like, you should keep going with that. Because I would sit in here and I would sit in that room with him and just talk about all of these anxieties that I had. At the point, I was like in a relationship with this guy and I was thinking about leaving that relationship. And I thought, maybe I can't leave it because who else is going to love me because I'm trans. And like, once they find out that I'm trans, they're not going to want to be with me. And I had all these pathologies in my head that I had learned from the world that I grew up in, that I was not deserving and worthy, right? Mm-hmm. Of love and affection and all this stuff. And so I was in therapy to unlearn all of that. Mm-hmm. And so he believed that there was a part of me that like wanted to express so much of this stuff but had never really expressed it. And he was like, you have quite the story. You should probably sit down and think about like really just spending time in the morning before you go to your job at People Magazine and go and, you know, sit and just write for yourself for 1 hour. That's all you have to commit to doing. It doesn't have to be good, you know, but I think that you'll really, I think there'll be a lot of healing that you can do for yourself. And that's kind of where my first book began, was through those journaling to myself.
Extraordinary moment happens when you're writing, you know, this hour every morning. You start to find yourself, and before you know it, there's a book. Mm-hmm. And it's a, I can't recommend it highly enough. But there's a significant person comes across your book, and it's a man named Ryan Murphy. You've heard of him. And he has a lot of interest in queer communities and so on. Mm-hmm. How did Ryan get your book?
Agents, I assume. he was looking for... I think he was looking to add a trans woman of color into the writer's room. Mm-hmm. I didn't think he knew.
In what show?
For Pose.
For Pose.
For Pose, which is a series that premiered on FX in June. Mm-hmm. It made history for, assembling the most, trans actors as series regulars. Yes. There's five trans women of color who are the centers of the show, in addition to the magnificent Billy Porter. And so our show was really, so anyway, before that, he requested a meeting with me. I flew to LA. I met with him on the set of Versace, which he was directing. And he told me right away about Pose. Mm-hmm. He told me what he wanted from me, which was to move to LA and write on the show. Mm-hmm. And you should come, it's gonna be fun. And that was our meeting, really. And then 3 weeks later, I was in LA, and I started working on the show and as a writer in the writer's room.
And had you ever worked in a dramatic form before when he hired you?
I was very dramatic, but no. No, I hadn't. And I always thought that maybe I would adapt one of my books for the screen in some way, and that's how I would get my in the industry. I never knew that I would be hired as a writer and then quickly promoted to producer doing the pilot. And then we said that you'll get to direct the script that you wrote as well.
Let's look at that clip, please, of Janet's directorial debut on Pose.
You're gonna leave him? We have children. I'm a mother before I'm a wife.
Maybe that's the problem.
The problem is my husband is a weak man who lies. I let him lie. His lies let me keep pretending.
Pretending what?
That all I ever wanted was to be Mrs. Stan Bowes. I still love him.
Me too.
Did he ever tell you he loved you?
Yes. Do you think he could love me and love you at the same time?
What were you doing in that big hall with all those gay men and drag queens?
That's my home.
You live there?
No, honey. My community. Mi familia.
But how could a woman be a drag queen?
Transsexual.
No, I don't believe you. Thank you.
It's a compliment, you know.
No, that's not possible. I mean, Stan would never, never do that. You're a woman.
100%.
Prove it.
What, you want to see my dick?
Yes.
I'm sorry for what I did to you. And I'm here to talk. But I got boundaries. I'm not bothered by any part of who I am except that. Everything I can't have in this world is because of that thing down there. If you want to see who I am, that's the last place you should look.
If you could, would you direct the film version of Redefining Realness, which really does need to be on screen?
I am writing the script now.
Yay!
And
can I ask something shady?
Okay.
Who's going to play you? Who could play you?
Well, there's a couple versions of me in it. So we have the narrator version, which would be present day me at age 26 then. Mm-hmm. It's the framing is that she's telling her story to a guy that she's falling in love with, or mm-hmm. I am telling my story to a guy that I'm falling in love with. I would love India Moore to play me.
Oh.
Yeah.
The minute I saw her, I said, that is a star.
Oh, yeah.
because you can't not look at her.
Yeah.
Brilliant casting.
Yeah. You said brilliant casting.
thank you, Janet.
Thank you. Hilton. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Staff writer Hilton Auld's talking with the writer, director, and activist, Janet Monk. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. I'm David Remnick. Given Donald Trump's tough stance on trade, it's a little hard to understand why he pushed a deal to bring a Taiwanese electronics maker to the United States, a deal that hands the company $4.5 billion in government subsidies, the largest subsidy ever given to a foreign corporation. We'll dive into the story of Foxconn next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Chris Hayes was only 34 years old when MSNBC took his show to primetime, making him the youngest primetime host on a major cable news channel. In the 5 years since it went daily, Chris Hayes also found time to launch a podcast and to write a book about racial inequality in America called A Colony in a Nation. All In with Chris Hayes deals with deep and even wonky discussions of politics and policy. And like his colleague Rachel Maddow, Chris Hayes doesn't make any pretense whatsoever of objectivity. He's a sharp critic of the president and almost all of what he does. But Hayes is also willing, more than willing, to get personal in how he talks about covering the news. And he spoke in 2018 with The New Yorker's Andrew Marantz about the toll of producing a daily news show in the era of Donald Trump.
The nature of the job that I have right now and the nature of the news right now means that you're constantly locked in this weird kind of it's like a digital roller coaster or something, or like an amusement park ride, where like you're constantly getting sensory input and having sensory and somatic responses to it, which is also part of what makes it weird. Like I care about the outcomes in the news. So when things happen that are bad, I feel bad. And that emotional response is just part of a whole variety of responses that are intellectual and professional and journalistic.
And there is, by the way, not to stop you, but there is a school of journalism that says you're not supposed to feel good or bad about what happens.
Right, and I sort of envy people that are in that position at some level, because I think it would be less emotionally draining. It feels sometimes like the adrenal system of the body is going all the time. And I also worry that that's like slowly eating away my ability to think. Mm-hmm. Like, I definitely think I'm getting stupider. I think maybe we're all getting stupider.
Yeah.
despite my very, very large brain.
That's the kind of thing where you're like, is it good for me that I saw that? And I have that clip.
No,
of-
that's unambiguously a good thing. I played that for people over breakfast this morning. Yeah. I was like, you got to see this one. My job requires me to be in the thick of the news cycle. Yeah. And at one level, I meet people all the time who are like, it must be so amazing to be at the center of this remarkable moment. And I say, yes, it is. And it's a tremendous privilege to do the job I do and get to talk to the people I talk to and try to have an, and also frankly, just from a personal and selfish perspective, like have an outlet for it. I think I would be going crazy if I was like sitting in a law firm somewhere, just like refreshing Twitter, like, like yeah. I can like go on air and say like, this, you know, we shouldn't kidnap kids. Right. But it's one of these things where I'm racked continuously all day, every day, through the day, in the run up to the show, during the show, and after the show with self-doubt about my approach.
In what sense?
I just feel like we're screwing up all the time.
Like, in what ways? Like,
there is some way in which the entire attentional universe is now orbiting around this one figure, and all he cares about is the attention. And it sometimes feels like we are collaborators against our will in a kind of project that emanates from just about the most deeply broken place in a human being I can imagine. Mm-hmm. Just something we're really profoundly, like when you dig past and you think about it in a sort of spiritual or like human sense, like there's some very deep broken need for the need to impose attention on oneself to the entire universe. Mm-hmm. And that, basically, that he kicks the ball and we all run after it. Mm-hmm.
In terms of, so, you know, to acknowledge that, you know, two white guys with glasses are talking about...
It's the glasses, really, that does it.
I know. Do you, to acknowledge that, but also the question being, you know, you have a TV show. Do you ever, and I assume you won't take this the wrong way, but do you ever feel like, in this moment, now more than ever, blah, 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 I feel weird being a white guy taking up space on TV.
Yeah, yeah, I do. I mean, I think that in our case, my words are not a majority of the show, mm-hmm. And so that's why guesting is incredibly important to us, and particularly, I mean, we are really extremely focused on that in guesting, diversity, and you know, people that aren't heard of all the time.
You keep track of it?
Oh yeah, very closely. Yeah. I mean, it's a thing that we talk about in the meeting, yeah. The daily meeting. It's something that I will occasionally audit. I'll have an intern just go through and make a spreadsheet to see how we're doing. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. Well,
spreadsheets.
Yeah. Spreadsheets and glasses.
The New Yorker Festival.
Yeah. The New Yorker Festival. Yeah, no, I think about it a lot. I do think about taking up space as a straight white man with a lot of advantages and privilege in my life. And if you have relative amounts of power and social capital, then like it is simply your moral duty to both use the imaginative gifts that evolution has provided us with, to imagine yourself in other people's shoes, and to act to their benefit as a basic compulsion of justice.
There is a, yeah. I justice got more applause than spreadsheets, which I'm happy yeah. about. I went to a Vipassana meditation retreat once where they...
a silent one? Like
yeah, 10-day silent.
You did 10 days?
I did two of them. It was, yeah. It's hard and shitty in a lot of ways, but I would recommend it. But... But the reason I was not planning to bring that up, except to say that there's a question about empathy in this. I'm not like, you know, dogmatic about Buddhism, but I found this really interesting that there was a question of empathy and loving kindness and how squishy does it get? And the teacher said, I forget what the example was, but it was like, if you see someone about to get hit by a train, you push that person out of the way. So it's not like pushing is a thing you don't do. But you try not to do it out of hatred.
Right.
So it's not
right.
like.
That's great. That's good.
So it's like.
I'm gonna steal that.
If right. It's a good one. Cause it's like, if a very powerful person is in charge of an apparatus that is putting children in cages, you don't have to not interrupt her during dinner necessarily.
Ding, 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 ding. But you have to view her as a human being.
Right.
Like exactly. Right. Like it. And to me, that's that. There's a difference between like civility and humanity. Like mm-hmm. I actually thought that in the case of Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the dinner was like the perfect example, right? Where it was like the owner like has a conversation with her kitchen staff, some of whom are like, this is in the midst of the child separation thing. And she comes out, she comps her cheese plate, and she asks her politely to leave. And
civilly.
It's like, she civilly, yeah. That's a civil action that is like, to my mind, a totally just one,
yeah.
Particularly in the frenzy of what that was. I mean, at that time, there were 2,000 kids who'd been stolen from their parents. And I think that's a great example of that practice. Like, she didn't treat her like a, you know, she didn't punch her and she didn't spit on her. And
right.
She, you know, but she made her action clear from a moral perspective as a human being to another human being
right.
Who's responsible for what they do. And part of what we're seeing with the Kavanaugh hearing is just the danger in all this, right, is that empathy is used by the powerful towards the powerful.
Right.
Why do you feel sorry for him and not me? Like, watching those Republican men after man after man after man say, like, I am so sorry for you, Brett Kavanaugh, for what you are going through and the pain on your face and how horrible it's been for you after they've watched this woman bare her soul about this trauma she experienced. And just it was like all there. And they were being, again, like, yes, it's been a horrible few weeks for Brett Kavanaugh in many ways. And like, I understand they, but again, it was like, who gets empathy and who doesn't? Those men sitting up there are imagining a world in which they're not imagining the world. Because they're not doing the practice
right.
Of being a 15-year-old girl who's scared at the moment that a hand comes over your mouth
right.
And the music goes up and you think something horrible and life-changing is about to happen and is happening because they don't do the work to think about putting themselves in that position. What they do think about and what is accessible to them is the idea of being accused of being a powerful man on the precipice of the moment, on mm-hmm. the threshold of the thing,
mm-hmm.
and having it all stolen from you mm-hmm. because someone accuses you. And that they can relate to.
Very transparently what the president can relate to.
I
mean,
yes.
And he's not hiding it.
No.
How do you know how long to do the show? Like, how do you know when you, like?
Definitely not forever.
Uh-huh.
To me, there's like a learning curve question
uh-huh.
about how long I feel like I'm still getting better at it. And when I am not,
mm-hmm.
There's lots of different things I want to do with my adult career. There's lots of different interests I have. There's lots of different mediums I like. There's lots of different ways I want to say what I have to say
mm-hmm.
that are not a nightly cable news show. And mm-hmm. so I think there's a lot of other stuff that I will do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be there for the near future,
mm-hmm.
certainly through 2020,
mm-hmm.
but I will not do it forever.
Mm-hmm.
Would have been messed up if you guys applauded.
Chris Hayes. Thank you.
That's The New Yorker's Andrew Marantz talking with Chris Hayes of MSNBC. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and coming up, the musician and film director Boots Riley. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Sorry to Bother You has been described as the most original movie of last year, at least by some critics. And it may not be Oscar bait. It's sort of science fiction, absurdist, and definitely very satirical. The movie is about a guy who's down on his luck and takes a telemarketing job where he learns to use a white voice, a perfect facsimile of how white people are apparently supposed to talk. And as his career takes off, he's forced to pick a side in a labor dispute. As trenchant as the movie is about race and identity, Sorry to Bother You turns out to be an extremely sharp critique of capitalism. The movie's writer and director is Boots Riley. Riley spent more than 20 years as a musician working with the hip-hop group The Coup. He's 47 now, and Sorry to Bother You is his first film project. The New Yorker's Doreen St. Felix asked Boots Riley what inspired it in the first place.
All I knew was that it was going to take place on a telemarketing floor. It was going to take place in the world of telemarketing. And there was going to be a struggle that he had to decide what side he was on. Mm-hmm. I didn't know there was going to be anything fantastical in it. I was thinking about story the whole time. I didn't start thinking about the aesthetics of it until I had the story.
Is there any autobiographical element in the Cassius Green character? Obviously, you worked as a telemarketer in the past, but Sorry to Bother You is a story that could have been told from so many perspectives. Were you making a very conscious choice to make the protagonist be this black man who starts to debase himself, like, who is a scab, as someone who, you know, you don't like scabs. That's not part of your...
If you don't, the choice is too, you make the choices too easy. Like, what, they're just going to have a debate about it. And he's like, yeah, you know, you're right. You know, I have to bring people through that thought process, right? And so that's part of it. Also, all of the characters, there's autobiographical elements in it in the sense that I didn't try to pick characters that I needed to research to figure out how they would respond in this conversation. I just wrote all of the conversations, all of the lines were me talking to myself.
Millions of dollars went into these walls just to make sure that thousands of calls can go out and in at the same time without jamming the lines.
You studied the script?
Yeah.
Look, clock in. Don't be lazy, and I won't have to be an asshole. Make a sale, this light goes on. You do real good, eventually, you might even be able to be a power caller.
A power caller?
Where the callers are ballers. Where they make the real money. They even have their own elevator.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
And stick to the script.
So, obviously, movies take a very long time to get made. And I keep thinking, if Sorry to Bother You had come out in 2013, it would have seemed completely prophetic. Because at that point, I think there was still the belief that a lot of these like tech guys were just harmless boy geniuses in a way. And then the election happens, and Facebook happens, and we all realize that they're going to kill us. Did you feel like you were in a race against time, a race against the public conception of what was happening with the tech boom and its, you know, radiating effects in Oakland?
No, this movie wasn't about the tech boom. I mean, it could have been made in any year that we've had capitalism, pretty much. I mean, the ideas that it talks about are ideas that happen, you know, in different industrial eras as well. And so, yeah, I wasn't thinking. I maybe thought of the personality
of the
Steve
Army, Hammer.
Yeah,
Army.
Yeah. Right. In terms of the tech boom, because you know, it's like this idea of the new capitalism is no capitalism. There is no capitalism here. What are you talking about? This is like, I know it's called capitalism, but it's not really that. It's, you know, like, it's not a place to work. It's a beanbag room. You do stuff here. You don't work, do stuff. This is called do stuff. It's not called work. And, you know, I'm not your boss. I just kind of tell you what to do. So there's that aspect. And so I wasn't, you know, I wasn't worried about any of that. It's possible that it may have been taken differently by certain gatekeepers that liked talking about it. I mean, because there were a lot of things about capitalism that were forgiven by big media companies while Obama was in office. Things that we had said we were against under Bush that all of a sudden we could turn a blind eye to, or not we, but publications could. And anyone saying something otherwise kind of seemed like just this harebrained nut as far as publications were concerned. So maybe it wouldn't have gotten as much print or articles about it. I don't know. That's just speculation.
So I've read that you don't like using the term capitalism.
In my artwork,
right.
I don't use the term capitalism. Besides telling people that they should nominally be against capitalism, that's not my goal at all. My goal is to have people be against capitalism. I want my art to inform, you know, be more personal about how we think about the world and how things work.
I was reading an interview with you, and the journalist says that there is a photograph that exists of you as an infant holding a copy of Fanon's Wretched of the Earth. Is that true?
Yeah, I learned to read as an infant and really got into that part of psychology.
Right, but the point is that you do come from a long line of activists. Your parents met at the 1968 student strike at San Francisco University. Did you feel predestined to be an activist and an organizer?
Well, I knew that my parents were involved with things, but it was not clear exactly what they were involved in. By the time I was 8, they were burnt out and kind of went on to other things. And since then, my father, you know, got back into being an activist and an organizer. But there was a period after between like 8 and 15 or something where he was just being a public defender, which he thought was actually social justice work. He thought of that. And he's also known as a civil rights attorney. But his organizing earlier, I didn't know so much about what was happening. I just knew he came home one time with his ribs bandaged up and said that they had just been fighting the Klan in Chicago, and somebody got him, you know, somebody got him with a sucker, you know, hit with a 2x4. And so I knew, like, okay, the Klan is bad, you're supposed to fight against them. So he didn't push ideas on me.
Right.
And the good thing about that is that as I came into certain ideas, I knew, one, that he wouldn't be, I knew enough to know that they wouldn't be mad at me for getting involved in organizations, but I also could think of it as my own thing. So later, that's kind of how I got involved, in the sense that he still had friends that were in these organizations, and some youth organizer that was connected to Progressive Labor Party was like, hey, do you want to go to the beach? I was like, yeah. And he showed up at my house with a van full of 14-year-old girls. I was 14. And saying, you know, yeah, we're going to go to the beach, but first we're going to go support the Watsonville cannery workers strike. Do you still want to go? So that's how they got me in the van.
That's a much better turnout than most stories of young children entering vans.
Yeah.
What was the first action that you led or participated in?
Well, first actions that I participated in was that same summer after I went in that van ride, I decided to become part of the summer project, which was Progressive Labor Party and NCAR's support of a farm workers union that was being organized in Delano and McFarland in Central California. And I think I wouldn't have done, you know, I was, as a teenager, very concerned with being cool and definitely not, you know, standing on the corner with a bunch of older white dudes passing out flyers about revolution. It just was not considered cool. So I wouldn't have gotten involved in that way without those summer projects. But getting involved with that and seeing these folks actually do something, that made me look at my own world back in Oakland differently. And I came back, and the first thing, like when we got back, was that Oakland Public Schools was going to have year-round school. So that's an easy issue to get students on the other side of. And we built up a campaign and called for a walkout, and it was the easiest. I haven't had an easier campaign that I've been involved with since then. But we called for a walkout like a few days to happen a few days later, and 2,000 of the 2,200 students started walking out. We marched about a mile and a half down to the school district offices, and we marched down. Other schools started coming out. As soon as we got to the school district office, the superintendent came out and read a prepared statement saying, we've decided not to have you around schools. Thank you. And so everybody, I mean, we got drunk off power.
So I'm going to shift gears a little bit to talk about, when does a young Boots Riley know that he wants to be a rapper, he wants to be a musician?
I just spit the dope lines. I don't snort them. Tell the boss to call police to escort them. You don't ride out them lies, you just quote them. Get offline, plug into this modem. No, you can't outvote them. The rules are still golden. Only jewels we holding zippy garden.
So we have that refrain, don't talk about it, be about it. And that's, I think, central to Boots Riley's politics and also his work. And so,
well, the other aspect of the story is, I think, before I got in that van, I wanted to be Prince. And I was taking guitar and piano and trumpet, and but I didn't want to practice as much as Prince did. I just wanted to be able to do that. And but I then started seeing how much music really helped with things. I had written a play for school.
What was it called?
So the teacher asked for a Oakland version of West Side Story. So East Oakland, we did East Side Story. And I wrote raps, and I had never written raps before. And nobody laughed or booed. So I was like, oh, maybe I could do that. And later, when we were, you know, a few years later, we were organizing in these projects called Double Rock in San Francisco, going door to door, selling newspapers, kind of organizing around this vague notion of fight racism. I don't know what that means, and I don't think we did then. But it was like, join an organization to fight racism. That was our basic pitch. One Sunday that we went, the day before, something had happened that everybody told us about. What had happened was these two twins that were 8 years old were stopped by the police. The police claimed they were selling drugs. And police felt like they didn't cooperate with them, started trying to take them into the car, and ended up, people saw them beating the kids. Rossi Hawkins, their mother, ran down to stop them, and she started getting beaten too. And the whole project saw this, and they all ran out. And the cops got scared, shot up in the air. And if you've ever been around a gun going off, the only logic you usually will know is, get the hell away from here. You know, let me get away. How do I? And so everybody ran. But at some point, everybody ran back. And by the end of the night, there was turned over police cars, and the police ran out of there without their guns. And they got Rossi Hawkins and her kids to the hospital. This was the summer of 1989, and the biggest hit on the radio was Public Enemy, Fight the Power. And somebody started chanting as they were running away, fight the power, fight the power, fight. Then they all started chanting it, and they ran back. It made me see that, you know, what place music could have. You know, a rallying cry, as it said. And so right then I knew, okay, this is what I have to do. Problem was, I had written those raps, but I wasn't a rapper. I wasn't good. And just being involved in a discipline organization up to there made me realize that that was just an obstacle, that that didn't make it impossible. It just made me realize that I had to figure out how to get good so that I could do this.
I'm interested in knowing, you'd gone to film school for a couple of years, right? And then you decided to be a musician and while also organizing. When did the dream that you'd had of making film, when did that reawaken for you? And when did you start pursuing script writing and thinking about projects?
Well, I think I had it in my, and to be clear, by the time I started doing music, I had pretty much stopped organizing. I had a period where I did quit music again and start organizing. I'd never really been able to do them both at the same time. I did this project with Tom Morello called Street Sweeper Social Club. And just half a clap. And we made songs, but it wasn't satisfying. And I came out of that really wanting to create something that was all out of my brain. And, you know, you could create a whole world with a film. I had the idea that I was going to make films in my head the whole time.
Boots Riley, thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
That's Doreen St. Felix talking with the activist, musician, and now filmmaker, Boots Riley. And that's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour this week. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening to the show. Until next time, please follow us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with help from Rhonda Sherman, David Ohana, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.